Welcome to episode 90 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I run a membership program called The Paper Year and teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Today, I'm talking with Catherine Miller, who has had an interest in making things out of paper since early childhood and still believes that anything, except perhaps internal combustion engines, can be made out of paper. After being sidetracked in adult life by a short career as a theatrical designer, then a 20-year career as a textile artist, Miller returned to playing with paper in 1994. Since then, as Biopia Press, Miller has published limited editions of conventional books and produced multiple artist books, altered books, and paper toys. Through the Biopia Press weekly blog, she offers frequent DIY projects for readers, as well as sharing her own works in progress. Enjoy our conversation. Catherine Miller, welcome to Paper Talk.
Hi, Helen. Nice to see you face to face.
Yeah, we've been internet pals for a long time, I guess, and following each other, but it is lovely to finally see you. So tell me a little bit about your artistic background from childhood on. I read somewhere that you started folding paper when you were three.
Actually, the first episode when I was three, my mother gave me a pair of blunt-nosed scissors and some scrap paper, and I apparently filled the entire house with little tiny bits of paper. I was probably about eight or nine when I learned to fold paper cranes. Uh-huh. And I folded 1,000 because that's what one does when one is a child and one learns about the cranes of hope.
Yeah.
I've always had a fascination with paper. Most of the papers I encountered as a child were, of course, Western papers, but I would occasionally get things from, I had relatives who were missionaries, and we would occasionally get things, and the packing papers fascinated me because they were just newspapers, but they were from other countries and the words were different and the texture of the paper was different. So it was obviously made a different way.
Right. And when you folded those 1,000 cranes, what did you fold those from?
I folded them from scrap paper from things like magazines.
And did you carefully cut squares?
Yes.
Yeah.
By hand in those days with a ruler.
Yeah. Wow.
I figured out after a while that I could stack pages and tape them to a surface and cut them with a knife. I used a scalpel. Mm-hmm. Because the X-Acto scalpels were available, but that was a highly dangerous activity.
Right. And I don't remember the first time I encountered a scalpel. What did your parents do that they obviously helped you get tools and get equipped?
Well, I had the advantage of having a brother who was 9 years older than me.
Okay.
So when I was eight or nine, he was finishing high school.
Okay.
So he'd taken, I presume we had a scalpel in the house because he'd taken a biology class. So I raided his room.
Got it. Oh, cool.
My parents were actually let me do a lot of things when I was a kid. I was the calm one in the family. So I was permitted to do things because I seemed to be risk averse. That mm-hmm. is, I could look at a situation and say, you could get hurt doing that, mm-hmm. which neither of my siblings were. They were the ones who would do things like jump off the second floor balcony of our apartment into a pile of snow while I stayed in my room and read.
Right.
Because it looked dangerous.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Well, thankfully, they didn't convince you to be the guinea pig.
No.
Yeah,
they were fine.
Yeah. And where did you grow up?
I moved a lot. I grew up pretty much all across Canada. Okay. My dad worked for an American manufacturing company that made trucks and farm equipment. And he was a district manager and he was a problem solver. So mm-hmm. whenever things would start to go sideways in a district because of mismanagement, my dad would get called in. So mm-hmm. we would move. Montreal was the longest I lived in one place, and I lived in two different places in Montreal during that time, because Montreal was, I guess, a real disaster when my dad got there. I've lived as short a period as 9 months in a city. Uh-huh. So I've lived not quite coast to coast, but Quebec, Ontario, and Alberta.
Wow. So, wow. And so are you bilingual? So,
I wouldn't call myself bilingual anymore. I would be again if I was, stuck in a situation where I had to speak French, but yes, I was bilingual. I went to school in both French and English when I was in Quebec.
Okay. Okay. Wow. And so what did you focus on art anywhere in school, like in high school or?
My mother, I think, recognized that I was gifted. So during that time we lived in Montreal, there was a children's art program on Saturday mornings at the Montreal Museum of Art. And it was in the basement. I remember the linoleum floor. Mm-hmm. But, so I was quite little, but it was taught by, I mean, one of the group of seven, which are very famous Canadian artists, was the art instructor for this group of little kids on the floor on Saturday morning.
Uh-huh.
So my mother recognized that I had artistic gifts. Mm-hmm. And I also had piano lessons and all of that. And mm-hmm. she was a great believer in training people to do things. And so I had gymnastics and I had swimming and I had all kinds of things. But yeah, I did get exposure to art quite early.
Oh yeah, that's wonderful. And then what did you do after high school?
I went into fine art at University of Toronto.
Okay.
And it was the wrong place at the wrong time. Mm-hmm. So I moved, my parents were then living in Ottawa. So I moved to Ottawa with my parents and I took a 1 year vocational commercial art course. So it's a certificate program, mm-hmm. which would have qualified me to get into the final year of Ontario College of Art. But I felt like my brain was dying because I wasn't getting enough intellectual challenge at the time. So I went back to university and took honors English.
Ah, okay.
So, and then I ended up working as a geological draftsman.
Ah,
the skills I learned in the commercial art course turned out to be useful.
Right.
I almost had a job doing things like the dioramas in the Natural History Museum in Ottawa, but the funding fell through while I was in the office.
Oh, gosh.
So he was about to hand me the contract to sign. And then it was taken back because he got a phone call while I was sitting there saying, I'm sorry, there's no funding for this program anymore. So that would have been a fun job. But
yeah. And how did you find the geological drafts person job?
Well, my brother was a geologist, and one of the people he had worked with was then now working for the Geological Survey of Canada. Uh-huh. And he sort of commented casually that they were looking for part-time draftspeople to do things for publication. So when a geologist would prepare a paper for a presentation at a Congress, they needed slide images, they needed graphics and little maps and things. So I wasn't in the main mapping department and it was part-time. So I worked mornings and went to university in the afternoon and evening. Uh-huh. But I heard about the job through a friend of the family, basically. Right. And I was fortunate because when I went in for the interview, they took me into a room that had various kinds of projects, completed projects lying around, and said, could you do this? And I said, looking at them, I said, yes. Uh-huh. They didn't say, have you done this? because right. I would have had to say no. But they took me into a room with this giant piece of, it was a giant overhead enlarging machine. I've forgotten the proper name called by the company that makes it. And they said, can you use this machine? And I looked, there were instructions bolted on the front of the machine. I thought, I can read instructions. Yes, I can use this machine. So I got the job. And
you did everything by hand, I'm imagining.
Oh, yeah.
This is before computers.
Yeah. Definitely non-digital. Yeah, yeah. Computers were in use because one of the jobs I had was converting a digital printout of chemical analysis into something that humans could read. Uh-huh. So drawing three-dimensional crystals based on digital output from a computer.
Ah, right.
So that was computers were beginning to be used, but not for the production of images at all.
Right, right. Okay.
I'm old.
Well, we all
Letraset
are.
Letraset was still a big thing when I was in commercial art school.
Oh yeah, that was still around when I came along too. I think I'm about 15 years behind you.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. So then how did you discover paper? And you had some interest in fibers first and performance maybe?
Well, I married an actor. That's how that happened.
Okay.
I made my own clothes from the time I was nine. Not everything, but I did make my own clothes. My mother had supervised me up until that time, and I was not supposed to use the sewing machine myself, but mm-hmm. I did, and I broke it, and I. My mother was out and I took it apart because I figured I couldn't make my situation any worse. Right. And I took it apart and it was really basically a thread jam. So I cleaned the machine, I put it back together again. And when my mother got home, she knew I'd used it because it was working better than it had before. But she decided that if I could take it apart and put it back together again, I was safe using it on my own.
Right.
So I made a lot of my own clothes from that time. My grandmother was a great seamstress. And she made tatted lace and all those kinds of things. And my mother made most of her own clothes and most of the children's clothes as we were growing up. So dealing with fabric was sort of in the house.
Right. And because you moved around a lot, were you always finding the fabric stores?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Definitely. That was part of my childhood, was standing in fabric stores beside my mother while uh-huh. she looked at things. So I got a direct, I could probably still identify some textiles by smell because of that experience.
Wow. Like
real silk, pure silk, processed in certain traditional manners has a smell. Mm-hmm. It has a distinctive odor. So I could probably still identify certain types of fabric by odor from standing at fabric stores when I was a kid.
Wow. And I'm just curious, one more question about that, whether your mother and you would purchase a fabric because you liked it or just the amount you needed for a particular project or a little of both.
Money was fairly tight. So, yeah. So we would buy for specific projects. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. I later in my teens, I worked in a fabric store and, I would buy things ahead on spec and I would buy like a lot because I got an employee discount.
Right.
So I finally finished using the last of those materials probably 30 years later.
Uh-huh. Wow.
I had a trunk, right? With, yep. you know, the someday stuff in it, but.
Oh, and you managed to use them. That's great.
I did actually use it up.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Wow. Yeah, a lot of people don't do that.
No, they have what's called a stash, yes, and it yeah. just stays there.
Right, right.
Yeah, the paper thing, I was very interested in the Orient, in China and Japan when I was mm-hmm. growing up. So when we moved to Calgary, I had my first real exposure to identifiable Asian papers. There was a Chinese I think it was primarily a grocery store, but they had a whole room full of non-food things.
Oh.
And that included papers.
Mm-hmm.
So probably when I was about 15, I actually met my first real Asian papers, other than things stuffed into the corners of boxes that arrived from relatives. And I really was fascinated by them. So I did. I was one of those kids who read voraciously, and I read nonfiction as well as fiction. So I would go to the library when I found something I was interested in, and I would read everything I could get my hands on.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually knew quite a lot about Asian papermaking before I became a papermaker.
Uh-huh.
And when I switched to papermaking from weaving, having been a weaver for 20 years, because I developed rheumatoid arthritis and lost partial use of my hands.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have reduced sensitivity, though I'm on a really good medication now, but I don't have the strength in my hands to be a weaver anymore. Mm-hmm. I can't put a warp on.
So how did the weaving come to be? How did you get into that?
Oh, I was interested in, I've always been interested in textiles. And yeah. I decided that weaving looked interesting. And when we lived in Halifax, I signed up for, when I was unemployed, I signed up for a class. And then I got a job, so that didn't happen. And I bought a little, it's called a Pioneer Loom, a little tabletop mm-hmm. thing. And I bought a Peter Collingwood's book on rug weaving. And okay. I read books from the library and I taught myself to weave.
Mm.
I'm good at learning things from books.
Right, yeah.
So, and then that became a full-time occupation when we moved to Saskatchewan, not just mm-hmm. a little hobby.
Right. So you, did you make art or did you make?
I did both. My major income was from what I call production weaving. So weaving yardage and then making it into things. So I made scarves and jackets, and on one commission I made a tablecloth. On another commission I did a bedspread, which was huge, and I will never do that again. Uh-huh. Even if I could weave, because it became incredibly tedious. But I also did tapestry, and hangings done in non-tapestry method. So I did both right from the beginning.
Right. And how were you finding your commissions?
I did craft fairs.
Mm-hmm.
I started out doing two or three a year. By the end of the 20 years, I was just doing one big one, pre-Christmas one a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I did have a couple of gallery exhibitions as well.
Mm-hmm.
Three, I think, solo shows. And mm-hmm. I had work in other shows as well. So
right.
There's a very active craft scene here.
Right. And here is where? How long have you been where you are now?
I have lived where I live now since 1974.
Okay.
And I live just south of Saskatoon, which is one of the two major cities in the province.
Okay. And are
you... When I say just south, I mean, literally the city limits are on my northern property border.
And how large is your property?
20 acres.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. We inherited it, which is from an adopted grandmother. So that's... Okay. I don't think we would never have been able to afford to buy this piece of land.
Mm-hmm.
We still live in, we live in the oldest, most shack-like house in the neighborhood and are surrounded by well-paid professionals like doctors and lawyers.
Ah, okay.
So we've become the cute old people at the end of the road.
Well, hopefully they look after you too.
Oh, they do. At the beginning of COVID, our neighbors dropped in and said, you know, if you need anything, we can do it for you.
Yeah.
And then one of the women on the road commented, you're probably better prepared for this than any of us. And I said, yes.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Do you grow a lot of your own food?
We have a big garden, but I wouldn't consider it a major part of our, uh-huh. our diet. But yeah, we do grow. We have a big garden.
Right, right.
that's mostly David's job.
Okay.
That's his summer job.
Uh-huh.
Firewood is his winter job.
Right. Wow. So,
and snow removal.
Oh, that's a huge job. Yeah.
Not as big here. It's much drier here.
Okay. That's nice. Yeah. So you mentioned the rheumatoid arthritis and that sort of stopped you.
Initially the first thing I did was take up Kumihimo because it was a way of, using my hands without putting much stress on them and actually producing something. I'm a driven maker. I have to make things. So
yeah. And what is Kumihimo?
It's a form of Japanese braiding, and okay. You use a stand and the yarn is on weighted spools. So it's a braiding technique basically, mm-hmm. but you can do very complicated things with it, but there's no real stress on the hands because you're just lifting and moving spools. David built me a stand.
Uh-huh.
So that was the first thing, but there was nowhere for this to go. That is mm-hmm. to say, I mean, there was no end use.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always been fascinated by paper. So David built me a box deckle, and I got a big plastic pan from a hardware store and started making sheets of paper. Most of my initial stuff was made with recycled paper and mm-hmm. inclusions. But a little while after I started making paper, this came out. I'm showing Helen a copy of her book.
Paper making with plants. Yeah.
Paper making with plants. So that was the boon. And then I walked around looking at stuff and I kept saying, I can make paper out of that. I can make paper out of that.
Uh-huh.
And my local, I reached some degree of local fame when I wrote an article for the local craft council's magazine called I Could Make Paper Out of That, and talked about making paper out of horse manure.
Oh.
So people would yell at me in the grocery store, you're the lady who makes paper out of shit. Anyway, so a degree of local fame from that. And you can make paper out of horse manure. It's not very good paper.
Right.
But I let nature process it first before I deal with it, which means leaving it out so that the bugs can eat all the organic matter out of it and then letting it weather over the winter. And by spring, it's just a pile of fiber.
Right. Yeah. And many countries make different kinds of poo paper, elephant yeah. poo and wombat yeah. or something yeah. in Australia.
But I let nature do the really messy yes. part of the processing right. first. I do boil it because it can contain things you really still don't want to touch.
Right.
But it's mostly clean. It's mostly mm-hmm. just little shreds of cellulose by the time I pick it up.
Right. And how are you beating it? Do you do it by hand or in a blender?
I use a blender.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Uh-huh. For most of my fibers. I will pre-cut to length with a knife or scissors depending on what it is.
And but do you still make paper? Sounds like it.
I haven't for a number of years, okay. but I have fiber supply. I've got some short mulberry and some flax fiber downstairs that I'd like to play with. So
mm-hmm.
it's, I consider it a summertime activity
mm-hmm.
because I can do it outside and I don't have to worry about the mess. Doing it in the kitchen can get dangerous.
Right. Messy. Right. And did you or David make your own molds and deckles or?
Yeah, David, as I say, David made me a deckle mold. I just have the one.
Oh, that's right. And yeah. what about pressing? How do you do that?
Oh, I have, David built me a press.
Okay.
And being a little bit OCD about doing things properly, my paper is, I use a cardboard and blotter dryer system.
Okay. Yeah.
And then when it's still damp, I press it like mad. So I actually produce a fairly smooth between blotters I cut from old sheets. And so I actually get a fairly smooth paper. And I've made layered cardstock that's actually quite stiff and usable for packaging. I won a prize in a local juried craft exhibition for little boxes made out of paper using horse manure. I think they were intrigued by the horse yeah. manure element. That was a combination of recycled paper and horse manure, but But so I had the paper then had a use. But I've also been interested in books. So with all this piles of paper and things, I taught myself simple bookbinding, again, out of books, because I had all this paper building up and nowhere to use it. So I had to, so I started bookbinding.
Okay. And wait a second. So all of these things you learn out of books, do you have like a massive library?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And we also have a really, really good public library system in this province with a really a university grade library, interlibrary loan system.
Wonderful.
So if you if I can't find a book or buy a book, most of my books are secondhand. Actually, I'm a great scavenger of secondhand bookstores when I travel, the little bit of traveling I do. I could get pretty much anything I needed through the library system if I couldn't find it myself.
Right. So so somewhere around this time, the internet came about as well. And but maybe it's a little bit later that you, I mean, you, I know you're very active online.
Yeah, I wasn't really on the internet until about 2006.
Okay.
Yeah, I wasn't. I was using computers, but I wasn't on the internet until about 2006.
Okay.
And that was because the local cable company at the time was trying to beat the other market, as it were, for things like the satellite connection. Mm. And they offered us a free internet connection. And I mean, the cost of the trenching was stunning because I live in the middle of a 20-acre parcel. Mm. So they had to bring it in from the edge, but they did it for free.
Wow.
As a promo. And so, because we couldn't have afforded it otherwise. But right. so I got internet, and we were on dial-up to start with, which was, since I like looking at pictures, was just enormously frustrating.
Oh gosh. Yeah. Right.
So when we went to, that was on our phone. So when we went to cable the same year, it was just like the world opened up.
Right. So you were already making books at that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I started in about 10 years earlier making books.
And were you, these were artist books or?
Initially they were blank. They were blank books, journals. The my handmade papers were mostly used for covers and cover paper and end papers, because they were waterleaf papers. Really, they weren't sized, so you couldn't really write on them.
Right.
You could with a pencil, but not with anything liquid. Mm-hmm. So I used them as covers and end papers mostly. My first artist book was probably about 2004. And that was really pre-internet. So I didn't even know about, I knew about artist books vaguely from the late, back in even the 60s and 70s. But it was not a medium I had encountered face to face. But we had, we'd founded our publishing company earlier than that. That was around 1996, I think.
Okay, so tell me about that.
Yeah, David, as a hobby, is a writer. He's a very good writer and a photographer, and he thought it would be nice to do a copy of one of his journals, rewritten as a book. So not just the journal entries from one of our trips, walking holidays in England. Mm. And he thought, well, if we're going to make a book, we should have a publishing house. So. So we became a publishing house called Biopia Press, and it's a strange name, but it has a reason. Mm-hmm. I actually wrote a blog post about it, parodying the Just So stories. It's called How Biopia Press Got Its Name. Biopia Press is a reversal of the word presbyopia. David and I were both of an age where we needed reading glasses. Mm-hmm. And the condition that causes the need for reading glasses is called presbyopia.
Okay.
So we just flipped it.
Biopia Press.
Biopia Press. Uh-huh. So it's like many things that I do, it's a joke, which some people get because they know the word.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And so how did that go with the first book?
Oh, well, that one was a giveaway. That was for friends and family. Mm-hmm. And it was people liked it. It was a book and it had pictures in it and it had a story. So.
And how was it produced?
It was printed on a home laser printer and, okay, and hand bound in a very bad version of a Japanese stamp binding.
Okay.
Because I didn't know about Japanese stamp bindings at the time. I later learned about that from the really good book on Japanese binding.
Okay. Right.
Ikegama's book. I think, mm-hmm, I think his name's Ikegama. Mm-hmm. So,
okay.
So I wouldn't do it the same way now.
Right, right. Oh yeah, we evolve and look back and go, ooh.
That was bad.
Right. Okay, so I know we're covering a lot of ground here and a lot of years, but what year did you start your blog and how did that come about?
Oh, the blog started in, I can give you an actual official date. The birthday of the blog is July 7th, 2014.
Okay.
And I started that because I had a particular project in mind, the Wishing Star Project. I wanted a way to collect wishes from people. Mm. And the internet seemed like a good way to do it. Mm-hmm. Because I wanted lots and lots and lots of wishes. And I wrote each wish that I collected on. There was a little form on the website where you could submit a wish. It's not, mm-hmm, there anymore because the project's over.
Right.
But I would collect wishes off the internet. I also went looking for them in other places, but people did send me wishes. And I would write them on a strip of paper and fold each one into a Chinese lucky star. Mm-hmm. They're also called wishing stars. Mm-hmm. And I folded probably 70,000 of them over a period of 2.5 years. I would write out wishes in the daytime in it for an hour or whatever. And then I would fold them in while watching TV at night.
Is that because you got 70,000 submissions?
Well, see, they were either submitted or I found them on other sites, wishing sites, because there are sites on the internet where you can leave wishes.
Right.
So I scavenged those as well. And I also had a couple of events where I collected wishes in person, mm-hmm, and folded stars. Mm-hmm. And the stars were then used. It's only had one public exhibition, but it did get one. Mm-hmm. And it's the stars are displayed as a meditation labyrinth that you can walk. So you're walking between all these stars on the floor that are all these other people's wishes. Mm. And the piece when displayed that way is called The Persistence of Hope.
Beautiful. Is that on your website?
I think there are some pictures of it on, okay, my website.
We'll, yeah, link to it if I can find them.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, I didn't know we shared that interest in wishes because I've done a, yes, big wish project and I also collected wishes online. That was a little bit after yours.
Yeah.
But prior to that, I had done a project about motherhood. And I put the word out online. Yeah, it's very effective to,
yes, it's to, a good way, it's to a good way to people. Collect things. Anyway, that, yeah, was the only reason I started the, okay, blog and website. And, yeah, then, of course, these things take on a life of their own.
Yeah.
So now I post twice a week. I do a Friday night flick, which are mostly book related, but I occasionally go off on tangents like I'm fascinated by stop motion animation. So I do animation as videos as well from time to time.
And so Friday Night Flicks, again, is every Friday you post a video that people could watch on Friday night. Yeah.
I posted earlier in the day, my time, mm-hmm, but it's early enough. I think that most people in Europe who follow me can see it Friday night.
Right.
So I posted it 10 local time, mm-hmm, in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And then every Sunday I write a blog post. And once a month, normally once a month, I do a do-it-yourself project. So okay. It could be a paper toy, it can be an artist's book, and they're often not just blank artist models of books, although I do that, but they're frequently a complete artist book. So it's a way of, I consider it a way of additioning.
Mm-hmm.
So I design the book and I do the prototype and then other people make the addition.
Right. That's so cool. I love that. I love that. You're putting it out there and then it's coming to life all around the place. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So all around the world, people making their copy of the edition. And in December for the last few years, I think maybe four years now, not absolutely sure. Mm-hmm. I think 4 years, I do an advent calendar where there's a project every day for the period of Advent in December. And last year I featured, it was book related, almost all accordion books. The variations on accordions are almost infinite, but there were a couple of other forms as well. And previous years I either alternate between picking a shape or a theme.
Mm-hmm.
So the first year was stars, and there were lots of things that were not specifically paper, but they were all star shaped that you could make. The second year I did, it was basically started with letter locking and progressed to book forms that are descended from letter locking. And then the next year I did square as the theme. So I took a shape as the theme. So lots of different things made out of squares or square shaped when you're finished. So that's a big project every year, doing the advent calendar.
Oh, yeah. And this is an amazing resource that is on your blog that people can go back and find. And I think at least this year, maybe in past years, you have an archive with the list of all the 25.
Yeah, so you can go to one post and see all the other ones. Yes. Yeah.
Right. That's wonderful. Yeah. It's like your own little online library. Yeah.
Yes.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here. And I want to let you know that my new book, The Art of Papercraft, is now out in the world. The book offers a rich variety of projects that will delight crafters, artists, and designers alike, including paper votive lights, pop-up cards, folded paper gift boxes and envelopes, woven paper wall hangings, miniature one-sheet books, and much more. If you'd like an autographed copy, you can order that directly from me at HelenHebertStudio.com. And if the autograph doesn't matter to you, the book is available wherever fine books are sold. It's also available on Kindle. And by the way, my book, Papermaking with Garden Plants and Common Weeds, has also just been released on Kindle. And my other papermaking book, The Papermaker's Companion, has been available on Kindle for a couple of years. Now back to our conversation.
I was looking at your artist books, and again, these are on your website, but tell me about the artist book, Finding a Way.
One of the things that I'm interested in is people's obsession with time and predicting the future. So how they deal with the past, how they deal with what's ahead. And I like the structure of a meander book because it's a path. It's a way it leads from one thing to the next. So I used that structure, but I made it out of pockets so that each pocket could hold a different way of fortune telling, predicting the future.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun. I did lots of research for that one. That one was fun. And people like things that are hidden. People like things that are secret. So the fact that you can pull something out of a pocket to look at it or hide it back in, people really like, I think it's another level of interaction.
Right. And it hangs on the wall. Is that right?
It can be mounted on the wall, but it also, the copy I sold to the University Special Collections here in Saskatoon. It lives in a little box. It folds up like a normal Voss-Drehten or meander book. So the whole thing folds up
right.
and fits in a little cube.
Right.
Very elegant little cube, but functional.
Oh yeah, and there's stitching on it, and just
lots all the pockets are sewn mm-hmm. together, and mm-hmm. there's sewn designs on the pockets as well.
So, mm-hmm. And you mentioned
I consider paper a textile, so I'm quite happy to stitch it.
Oh yeah, me too. Yeah, yeah, I love stitching on paper. Do you produce editions usually?
Mostly I have produced editions. Mm-hmm. That one was fairly small. I think there were 5 copies altogether, because it was so labor intensive.
Right.
I start to get bored. Mm-hmm. As an indication of I start to get bored, I have a couple of editions sitting around that need to be finished. In one mm-hmm. case, they need the boxes made, and in the other case, they need and one box and an insert that gives you the text to be printed and folded. But they're there. Someday, maybe I'll finish them.
Yeah. I have that same issue myself. Yes.
They haunt me. I get distracted and I want to go on to the next thing.
Uh-huh. Totally. Yeah, I'm the very same. So you mentioned that this is in your local special collections, but I know you have artist books all over the place. How do you make contact with these?
I'm fortunate enough to be represented by Vamp and Tramp. Okay. And they are my major outlet for artist books.
Right. Wonderful.
I have sold some directly to private collectors and to a couple of collections, but most of my work that has been sold to collections has gone through Vamp and Tramp.
Right. Okay, cool. And then you also make altered books. Are those one of a kind?
I take a specific book, and though I did do a series and actually bought a copy of the book that it's made from, I did a series of altered books from the Time Life Nature Library that was published back in the early 60s. So it's the kind of thing my mother would buy because it's educational, right? Mm-hmm. But you can't give them away now for the most part. No, nobody wants them except people like me who want to turn them into something else. So I did a series that are one of a kind of those, but one particular one, the one on space, it's called The Universe. I did lay my hands on multiple copies of that book and did a number of different versions.
Okay.
Of altering, but they're all altered in a similar way. All of the pages are turned into stars. Froebel stars, also known as Danish stars and Swedish stars and German stars and Moravian stars and whatever. Anyway, those 8-point stars,
right.
Three-dimensional ones. So that's the only editioned altered book I've done, and each copy is unique. Mostly I take things and they're one-of-a-kind pieces.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. And then I know you exhibit your work as well.
Yeah, I enter juried shows.
Okay.
That's becoming more difficult with the increased cost of shipping.
Right.
So on top of the entry fee, if you live in Canada and you're entering a show in the United States, the shipping is really expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Much more expensive. I mean, I have considered driving down to the border and mailing things in North Dakota because the shipping is way cheaper.
Right.
And it's expensive in the States, but it's way cheaper than shipping across the border. And there are other hassles involved with border shipping. The exchange rate can be a problem. It's the difference in the American Canadian dollar. Can be prohibitive. So I've cut back on the number of American shows that I enter.
Okay.
But I also have opportunities locally. I've stopped doing craft shows because they're just too tiring, and I'm immunosuppressed by the medications I'm on for my rheumatoid arthritis. Mm-hmm. So over the last 20 years, I've seriously cut back on exposing myself to crowds and on traveling. So that's been reduced. I don't do the craft sales anymore, but the provincial craft council provides opportunities. You can apply for exhibitions So I've had several solo exhibitions with them. And I've entered group. They have an annual biennial group exhibition that you can enter. And I sometimes get work into that. Paper is an odd medium to enter in a craft show, because either the jurors will disrespect it entirely because it's only paper, or they'll get really excited. So I tend to either not get anything in at all or win an award. So it goes one way or the other. And it's unpredictable. People who you think might appreciate paper sometimes don't at all. Or you get told by the juror afterwards that your work was eliminated because it belongs in an art gallery and not in a craft show. Excuse me.
Yeah.
What? Didn't you read the instructions to the juror that tell you not to do that? Anyway, so I do get those opportunities. I do have one gallery that represents me locally. It's in a town outside of Saskatoon. I did have a gallery in Calgary, but the owner had a stroke and retired, and the new owners weren't interested in book and paper arts. And I was in conversation with another gallery here in Saskatoon, and he dropped dead of a heart attack. So,
oh, gosh.
So I'm not talking to him anymore. So I'll have to start over there. I have been invited to exhibit as well. So mostly people who have seen my work online.
Right.
So I've had several exhibitions that way. But it's a struggle.
Yeah, yeah. That part. Right, right.
Making things is not the difficulty. Finding places to put them is.
Exactly. Yeah. And I know you do projects every so often, like a 99-day project I think you did recently.
Yeah, that's on Instagram, and I do participate in the Are You Book Enough challenge on Instagram. I got onto Instagram because when I had my last solo exhibition at the Saskatchewan Craft Council, I was required to have a social media presence. Having had a blog online for 6 years didn't count. So I chose Instagram as the least offensive option. And I was posting daily, because if you want to build a social media presence in time for your exhibition in 2 years, you need to be there regularly. And I was aware of the Are You Book Enough challenge, but I didn't really participate the first year, and then COVID hit. And since I was less traumatized or otherwise affected by the idea of a pandemic and not being able to go anywhere, I was also aware of other people needing emotional support and psychological support. And so, like giving away book projects on my blog, I thought that participating in projects or creating my own projects and showing them on Instagram was a way of supporting that community. So remaining perpetually optimistic, not letting people know that I have bad days too. Well, letting them know I have them, but that I get over it.
Yeah.
That it's possible to get over it. I quite like the idea of the 99-day project because it makes you do something over and over again until they're usually 100-day, but I like the number 99 better, so I did that. It was an interesting process because I was doing the same thing every day just for like half an hour or an hour.
And what were you doing?
Oh, the 99-day project was I was creating... using a color every day, picking the background color often was influenced by my environment, like the weather or the salad I made for supper the night before or something like that. It was something in my little world. And then I would do a cutout pattern and layer another shiny paper behind it. And there was sometimes hand coloring. Yeah, there was usually hand coloring, and there was usually a printed color as well. So I would print I do a lot of work, design work digitally. So I would print a digital design of the cutout pattern with some additional color on a colored paper, because the layering of color makes it a very different impact than printing on white. And then I would sometimes enhance that with a fair amount of colored pencil. And then there would be the cutout design. So I was really playing with the idea of layering, different kinds of layering. Mm-hmm. So layering of color through putting color on top and cutting through to another color.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So that was interesting. I've been thinking about doing another one this year, is try to do a stop motion animation.
Uh-huh.
Do one drawing a day for so do a different drawing for the that, so at the end it could be put together to be an actual little film.
So
I'm thinking about that. I'm right. Still thinking about that. But I haven't decided yet. I might do something simpler, but we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah. And do you have any words for how you come up with ideas? Because you're just generating these ideas. Well, you have a structure of the 99 days. So maybe you finish one and then you're like, what could I do next?
Yes. The coming up with ideas thing is I often wonder how people don't come right. up with ideas, because it keeps me awake at night.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
It's one of the reasons for giving books away on the blog, is because I have more ideas than time.
Right.
You know, I'm over 70 now, so I don't have as much time as a young person does. And if I want these things to exist in the world, the fastest way to do it and the most efficient way to do it is to get other people to make them for me. So that's, I'm working on a project for this month for another thing for people to do. As I say, I usually try to do one a month. I did right. more during the lockdown phases. I did more projects for people, but because they needed things to do, especially if they had kids at home. So I oriented it more to that. But no, I have more ideas than I can possibly use.
Right. Do you keep them? Do you keep a journal too? You mentioned David's. No.
No. Mm-hmm. No, I do sometimes have a list. Mm-hmm. But I don't generally. My memory is still good enough. I don't need that yet. I probably should start developing the habit of writing things down.
No, that's good. I actually work very similarly. So I love just hearing about all these similar ways we work. Yeah. And you contributed a project to my new book, The Art of Papercraft, the Valentine yes. Love Note. Is there any story behind that? Or do you remember when that was on your blog originally?
Yeah, that was part of the letter locking okay. series mm-hmm. for an advent calendar, although it is a Valentine, but the fold is from that letter locking series. And it's actually a fold I did in high school because I moved around so much, I was constantly on the outside of whatever community I mm-hmm. was living in. I was mm-hmm. out the other, the alien. And one of the ways I discovered that I could make friends with people is paper folding.
Ah.
So in public school, it was cootie catchers, yeah. fortune tellers.
Right.
And in high school, it was folding notes for people. So girls would write MASH notes to some guy in class they liked. And uh-huh. I would fold it for them. And then they would take it back and have somebody smuggle it into a guy's pocket or into his desk or uh-huh. whatever. So, but it gave me a way of connecting more quickly with a new community. And high school, it's really hard to break in.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Because yeah. especially if you're in a community where all of those kids have been together since grade one.
Yeah, yeah. I did that to my children, unfortunately. We moved in middle school for them. And I know it was so hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it was
yeah.
probably easier for me because I did it so often. So I had developed right. techniques to cope with it.
Right.
But it was really hard on my sister.
Mm-hmm.
And I think possibly one of the reasons was the difference between us was that I was a reader and she wasn't. Mm. So I had a whole world of friends
right.
in books.
Right. Right.
That went with me no matter where I was. And my sister didn't have that so much. She was also dyslexic. and had television before she learned to read. So that made didn't it, that that took away that option for her. She was not a happy reader. She could read, but she was not a happy reader. So she was much more dependent on, you know, real life people for a sense of belonging. So I think it was much harder on her.
Yeah. It's interesting that you're saying that, because in families, I'm thinking of my own sister who was much more into television than me. And then my children, one of them was very bookish and the other one more social. So,
No, I was the bookish one.
I wanted to hear about your fascination with the Zhenzhen Bao, how that came about. Oh, and you have a section on your blog about that.
Yeah, that was one of those Pinterest wormholes. I saw, because I you know, I'll do searches for paper folding and origami and things because I'm interested in it. And I'm always happy to learn a new folding thing. Mm-hmm. And I came across an image of what I called the star box on the top of a Zhenzhen Bao. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I want to know how to fold that. And I looked and I found instructions for things that were sort of like it, but not it. Because I'd seen a video of it, you know, so I knew how it opened and I knew what it looked like. So I started searching for this thing and I found lots of stuff on the Chinese thread book, the Zhenzhen Bao. But it took, Pinterest is actually a wonderful search engine because I kept looking at things that looked similar. It kept finding new things that looked like that for me. And eventually it found me the book that was available free online that had the folding instructions for what that author called the flowered candy box. So if I'd been looking for the flowered candy box, I would have been able to find it much more quickly, but I didn't know what it was called. I just called it the star box. And Ruth Smith, who's done a great deal of work on the Chinese thread book, calls it the star box.
Okay.
So I was confused by that.
Yeah.
And I didn't have access to her. I now have her books, but I didn't have access. It was really hard to track her down because you have to buy her books directly from her. And I finally found her as well and managed to get the books, which have the instructions as well. But
I think Pinterest, it's on your blog.
Yes, where you can find it through my blog.
Because I actually bought them and I found her through you.
Yeah, so, I put her address on because I had a terrible time finding it, so I wanted it out there.
Right.
That's the other thing I do is I'm a great believer in the dissemination of information. If I have spent a long time learning how to do something and it's been difficult to get access to the information, once I have that information, I'm quite happy to pass it along. Because I don't think other people should have to waste their time repeating what I'd already done.
Right. It's very generous and makes total sense. Yeah. Love that.
I think that must be genetic. I have a cousin who's a librarian and she's part of the movement to liberate scientific information from behind paywalls and paid journal subscriptions. So it may be genetic. I don't know. Here I've learned something. You can have it.
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't spend your time trying to find it. Yeah. So what are you working on right now?
I'm actually my part of my day these days is made cutting mats, spent cutting mats for the series I just finished. A series of, I call them drawings. It's called On a Clear Day and it's an homage to a series of prints by Agnes Martin, who is probably well known to most people as an American artist, but she was actually born in the province I live in and grew up in the province I live in. So I think her work, and in particular that series of prints called On a Clear Day, are very much influenced by the landscape. That horizontal line that I don't have to, all I have to do is walk to the west edge of my property and I can see that horizontal line. And I live in a slightly rolling area. There are other parts of the province where you can stand and that flat horizon goes on for miles. So it's very much part of living in this place. And I felt a kinship to it.
Mm-hmm.
My parents are both from Saskatchewan, and although I grew up all over the country, when I first hit the prairie, when we were moving from Ontario to Alberta, my mom and my sister and I drove across, and I stepped out of the car and I thought, I can breathe.
Mm.
It was like being literally like being able to breathe for the first time when we hit the prairie. Mm. So there's something in me that really connects to this particular landscape.
Right. And so what is your On a Clear Day project?
It's a progressive series of, I call them drawings, but they're actually stitched on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And I've selected four colors to represent the seasons. So there's a cycle, it goes through, there's nine different drawings, and they're done four times each, once in each color.
Mm-hmm.
But they're tied together by, there's a blue horizon line that goes through all of the images.
Mm.
So I have finished sewing them all. I am now putting them in protective mats and into storage until such time as they, you know, someday might see the light. My fantasy is having them exhibited in some place like the National Gallery of Canada, which has the Agnes Martin piece, having them exhibited in the same room next year on the anniversary of her prints being made. I'm planning to post the last of them. I've scheduled the posting on Instagram so that the last one in my series will be posted on what would be Agnes Martin's 100th birthday.
Oh, wow. Year. Wow. Yeah. And so will you do anything to try to make that happen?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I seriously doubt that it will. I mean, the first thing I will do is when I post the last drawing, I will say fantasy time.
Right.
And list the Instagram tags of galleries that I know have the Agnes Martin collection, which would include MoMA in New York and the Tate Modern in London and mm-hmm. the National Gallery of Canada. So that will be the very first thing I do. And then I will do some emailing the images and things. But I don't have any serious expectation of that happening. But it's a nice fantasy.
Oh, yeah. And things happen.
Yeah. And if you don't poke, nothing. Right. Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, if I just sit here, nothing will happen. I can guarantee it. So,
Yeah. And where did you get your marketing expertise? Because you really know a lot.
Where did I get my marketing? You wouldn't see that reflected in my income.
Okay. Well, getting the word out, building your following, you certainly.
Well, my dad worked in management. And before mm-hmm. that, he'd been a really good salesman. Mm-hmm. I don't have his gift of being, he could make friends with anybody in five mm-hmm. seconds. Mm-hmm. He was that kind of guy. Although he's actually at heart really shy, but he had this persona that he could adopt.
Mm-hmm.
I probably used to wear a version of it when I did craft sales with the smile, you know, don't ever look bored. You always have to smile. Uh-huh. Don't look angry when people ask you the same stupid question for the 150th time. Smile and answer it. I was a really good fabric sales clerk.
Uh-huh.
Really good. I don't know. I think I probably picked up a lot of it from my dad.
That's wonderful.
Unconsciously, just sort of absorbed it.
Right.
And I understand, and I understand how systems work
mm-hmm.
a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and how people within systems work. So for instance, the Instagram thing of posting every day,
right?
People remember you if they see you.
Right. Yeah.
I am actually fairly invisible in my local community because of the not making. I don't go to openings,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
gallery openings. So I am. Pretty much invisible to the local art community.
Right.
I don't go to openings because I'm immunocompromised.
Right. Yeah.
And if you don't go to openings, you don't exist.
Mm-hmm. Well, cool. So let's get to your recommendations. So you had a couple. Just tell me why you like the Book Arts Listserv.
Oh, it's a huge resource.
Yeah.
I call it the hive mind. If you have any question relating to any of the book arts, that's the first place you should ask it. Mm-hmm. Because there will likely be at least one person who knows the answer to the question you've got. And there are people working in all kinds of different fields. There are paper makers, there are conservators, there are fine book binders, there are letterpress printers. I mean, anything to do with making a book. There are leather people who tan leather. There are, right? There's,
yeah,
anything to do with a book. There will be somebody who knows the answer to your book question on there. So it's a huge resource.
Yeah, it is. And you can actually do searches in, yes, the archives as well.
Yeah,
so often they have an archive, question has already been discussed.
Yeah,
this is one of the oldest listservs, I think. I mean, it's really,
yes,
been around 20 years or more.
I think it's more than 20 years now. But
right.
It's an incredible resource and searchable, as you say,
right,
in the archives.
Mm-hmm. And then the book Unfolded, Paper and Design Art, Architecture and Industry.
Oh,
I don't think I've seen that one.
It's out of print. It was printed, mm-hmm, in 2009, and it's from a German company, so you may not have encountered it. It was produced in at least four different languages: English, French, German, and Italian.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't tell you how to do anything, but it shows you what people have done.
Right.
And it shows almost every possible use of paper, including designing paper things that end up getting used in the space program, because that's how they fold the solar panel.
Right. Yeah.
So two dresses made out of paper. I mean, functional dresses, which was a thing in the 60s when I was a kid. But
yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Paper dresses. And the ultimate disposable fashion. But
yeah,
it's a wonderful resource in terms of, if you didn't know this could be made out of paper, here's a picture of somebody doing it. And it's not absolutely complete, but it's a great spread. And there are other books that do the same thing. That's just the first one that I came across. So it was influential in my perception of what paper could do.
Right. Yeah, that's cool. And we'll put links to all of these recommendations in the show notes. And then you mentioned this before, but Are You Book Enough? Just describe what that is.
Again. Oh, it's was started by Sarah Maker at Ink and All. She's a letterpress printer in, I believe, Seattle. And I'm not sure why she started it, but she started it. And it's a monthly book arts challenge. And there's a theme. So this month, the theme is food.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do anything bookish, and it doesn't have to look like a book when you're finished. It can be something else entirely. You could make a whole bunch of fruit out of paper with words of what their names on them. And that would be, but that's, see, I would call that a book. That's an artist's book.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it has participants from lots of different backgrounds. So we have textile people, we have paper people, there's at least one person who's got woodworking experience. There's some people with metalworking experience. So people, if they feel inspired, they respond to the monthly theme and contribute an entry. And it's not really a competition, but you're encouraged to pick your favorite nine after the month is over and post them. And that's a way of promoting other people's work on the internet.
So it's fabulous.
It's fun.
You can just follow the hashtag Are You Book Enough to see what everybody's producing. And then you can get involved. It's free and do it.
Unlike many things these days. It is actually free.
Wonderful. And where can we find you online, Catherine?
You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my blog and website. And I'm also on Pinterest, and people might be interested in that because I have boards specifically for bookbinding. I have books for paper toys. I have files for paper toys. So I have things saved in a number of categories that people interested in paper might be interested in. It's also another way of checking on my instructions from the blog. I have a group called My Instructions, and all of my instructions, there's an image for each of them there. So
yeah, you think Pinterest is like a library, a visual
it
library?
Is. And as I say, it's a really quite efficient, though not always fast, search mm-hmm. engine. Mm-hmm. It found me that right. origami right. fold. It took it about 10 days of showing things to me, saying, "Is this it? Is this it? Is this what you wanted? Is this right. it?" But it eventually did show me what I wanted. And so I find it's actually very useful that way, particularly when you don't know the name of something.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's a visual search. Cool. So I'm just going to read these in case people want to go right now to these web addresses, but we'll put these in the show notes too. So on Pinterest, it's pinterest.ca/biopia, BYOPIA, instagram.com/biopiapress. And then your blog and website is biopiapress.wordpress.com.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Catherine, it's been so fun to get to know you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. Maybe we'll get to meet in person someday.
That would be wonderful. All right. Thanks. Take good care.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can find out more at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps others find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on podcast, where you can find out more about these guys, subscribe to this series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon.
There's a reason besides the season, the main contain-